This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
A committee of the New Orleans City Council received a report yesterday as it relates to domestic violence cases in the city of New Orleans. And two of the council members had some criticism as it relates to the handling of these cases by the district attorney's office, District Attorney Leon Cannizzara. Joining us to talk about it, Kim Sport, Public Policy Committee Chair for the United Way of Southeast Louisiana, Charmaine Cassiope, COO of United Way of Southeast Louisiana and VP of Public Policy, both advocates who worked long and hard in the legislature on a number of domestic violence issues, as well as Mary Claire Landry, Executive Director of the New Orleans Family Justice Center. And that organization as well has been very proactive in promoting the rights of domestic abuse victims. So, ladies, we got this report. The numbers seem as though a number of cases are falling through the cracks. So, from your perspective, what's the root cause of the issue here?
Well, you're right, Newell. We got the report at the same time everybody else got the report. And when you see a report that says that over 3,500 cases are being dismissed in the municipal court, it just raises a number of questions. My concern as a victim's advocate is that if a victim finally has the courage to come forward, dial 911, or show up at a police station to report a crime of domestic abuse, then we think that domestic abuse has been going on for more than that one incident. And it takes tremendous courage to do that. And the last thing that we want to see as advocates is that these cases are simply dismissed and the alleged perpetrators are sent home where they have an opportunity to retaliate against the victim that reported them.
So when we were talking offline, I kind of look at this report, and I said then, and I'll say again for the benefit of the listening audience, the report is an outcome. It's the what. It's not the why. So why do we get to these outcomes? What is it that's missing in the law? What is it that we're missing from an organizational standpoint, whether that be the prosecutor, the investigative agency, the New Orleans Police Department, or is it a combination of a number of factors that run across the entire system?
Well, this is Mary Claire. I would say, after being in this work for decades, a lot of these misdemeanor cases are very difficult to prosecute and to meet the criteria and the bar of a criminal charge. So I guess what I would say as a root cause is if we're not going to prosecute them, don't send the message to the community that we're going to be hard on domestic violence and then just absolutely have no accountability for perpetrators. I would say let's take the money that we're using to, investigate and put the resources into an alternative intervention model where we're at least taking some action to address the family systems issues that's causing these misdemeanor cases to go. And then to use the criminal justice system to really use its resources, its very limited resources, to really prosecute the highest risk cases, which would be strangulation and those where there are use of a gun or a weapon, where we can really hold batterers accountable. It is clear the criminal justice system is not capable of handling these cases. It's very clear. It's documented well in terms of the failure. And I guess I just really would like to give a different message to the community and to victims out there that if you call the police, that something is going to happen to hold perpetrators accountable. And when we're dropping 90% of the cases because we can't deal with them through the criminal justice system, then we need to come up with a different way. We need to use our resources in a different way. And there are models across the country that have done this successfully. And, you know, I'm very happy to say the DA's office did reach out to me several times yesterday. We're meeting tomorrow morning. They are willing to reengage. And so maybe we can begin these conversations about if it's not going to be a criminal justice response, if it's not going to be a misdemeanor charge, then what is it going to be? And I think we have to work collaboratively.
Were you surprised by the number of arrests in a year, that 3,000 domestic violence arrests were made?
It's honestly, it's been running at 4,000, 4,500 for the last 20 years that I've been in. I mean, that seems to be the capacity of the system, even though we may have 18,000 calls for service. The arrest numbers have been pretty stable through the years. So that seems to be the capacity of our system to respond. I knew that the conviction rates on misdemeanors has been bad. I didn't realize, you know, how bad it is. And so I think we as a community have a responsibility to figure out what the answer is. If we can't convict these cases, we can't just send the message that there is no accountability for perpetrators. Because the reason this continues to go on is because perpetrators know they're getting away with it. And when you've been beaten and experiencing this, the reason victims don't cooperate is because they know nothing happens to the perpetrator. The response is very limited. They don't get jail time. They don't keep them safe. And the minute they're out of jail on bond, they're going to go straight back to the victim and do terrible harm. And so the fact that they're not going to call again is because they're scared. They are scared. There is no protection for them. So we have to come up with a different answer.
Why is this crime category different than a number of others? I mean, I do believe that we start with a little bit of an unreasonable expectation and premise when we say that because a criminal complaint is filed that we're actually going to get justice. I mean, as different players within the system, they can only play the hand they're dealt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where there has been success in this country as it relates to the arrest and prosecution of domestic violence cases have been places that have adopted a multidisciplinary team
that's
approach
correct.
To the problem.
And that's exactly and most what needs to happen.
And most importantly, funded it.
Correct.
So, you know, my perspective is that right now we know that the New Orleans Police Department's underfunded, understaffed. Right now, we know the DA's office is underfunded, understaffed. It seems to me to be, I understand the expectation. I don't want to use the word unreasonable because it is a reasonable expectation, but we got to put our money where our mouth is.
I absolutely agree.
Meaning the DA or whoever the DA is going to be, is not the funding arm. The NOPD is not the funding arm. And when I hear a council person say, why even bother calling the police? Why did I just risk my life as a police officer to go respond to a domestic violence case? I find that obnoxious because we're sending these officers on every other type of call that's every bit equally as dangerous. There's no ordinary call. There's no run-of-the-mill call. But yet we try to single out a player in the criminal justice system based on an outcome study. And we're not sitting down talking about the root cause analysis. So I called the DA's office yesterday, said, did y'all have a meeting? Did somebody tell you about this study being released? And did they reveal this to you so that you could look at it and have an opportunity to respond? And the answer was no. Well, if we're going to engage ourselves in an ambush strategy here, I would suggest to everybody that's even interested in domestic violence cases, that's a bad strategy.
Well, Newell, I couldn't agree, and I'd like to add my comments because, you know, when we made the success that we did, you were seated with us along with the district
Absolutely.
Attorney and everybody. What was the success in being able to implement the most historic legislation in Louisiana's history was because we did exactly what you just said. As a funder, United Way is making incredible investment in domestic violence, and we're making incredible investment in advocacy and policy. But you and I both know, because we sat with you you when you were sheriff of Jefferson Parish. We asked you to give us the information so that we could build the kind of compelling multidisciplined collaborative that could go to the state capitol and say, this is what we need to do and why. This is clearly what needs to happen. We need the resources, we need the collaboration, and we need effective input if we're going to move the needle.
But this is the problem where there's a disconnect. These same council members have been critical of the district attorney for being an aggressive prosecutor. And that, for whatever reason, goes out of the window when it's might be their favored crime that they want to have aggressively prosecuted. It doesn't work that way. There needs to be a systemic, consistent, consolidated approach to arrest and prosecution in any jurisdiction. And I would tell you that the jurisdictions that have been successful in these types of cases, they've been consistent.
I agree.
In their approach. And this fragmented approach where we have this ambush mentality, you know, is a problem. And what I know as a law enforcement guy, these are some of the most difficult cases to make. And in order to do corroborative evidence and bring it forth to the DA, when you have a non-compliant victim, 80% of the domestic violence cases in this country have a victim that changes their original statement, and they recount the facts. I understand about the control and the power and why this is so difficult, and I understand. I sat there in the chair next to everyone here advocating on this case. I understand, but we need to kind of get real and not politicize these things for the sake of whatever the political will is, and I find it very distasteful that we go down this, because what happens here, corroborative evidence, DNA. Do we have a DNA lab in New Orleans? The answer is no.
No.
We have to share with the Louisiana State Police. Do we have access to the technicians necessary in the crime lab? We don't even have a crime lab. I think that maybe they just opened one. So in the 2018 numbers and the 2017 numbers, there's no crime lab. So these are all impediments to providing this corroborative evidence, whether it be, you know, I know that you said, Mary Claire, that you would provide medical reports, and if they didn't receive those and act on those, then shame on them. They should. Mm-hmm. But there's so many impediments in this system right now that actually the council has more control over making that a priority than any of the criminal justice players. 'Cause why? It requires money.
Exactly.
If you don't have the tools necessary to do the job, if you don't have the funding of the overall system in this collaborative, multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary team approach, we can't rely on not-for-profits. I love not-for-profits.
Thank you.
But not-for-profits are not going to be the long-term solution to the problem.
You're right.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Absolutely.
No, I think the thing that jumped off of the numbers for me is that if the cases were misdemeanor cases in municipal court, 90.7% were not prosecuted. But if the cases were misdemeanor cases in criminal district court, then only 24% were not prosecuted. So I think that maybe these cases might be better dealt with in the criminal district court and not in municipal court, because I really doubt that we have this many misdemeanors, that we have this many offenders without another offense, without a first offense, or that some of these crimes classified as misdemeanors weren't actually done in the presence of a child, upon a pregnant subject, with strangulation or burning. I think that probably there are a lot of felony cases that are being charged as misdemeanor cases in municipal court, and that's what you were talking about before. There's a disconnect between what the police are finding and reporting, and then what evidence is there, and then what is finally charged, because I think a lot of these are probably felony cases.
Well, as a result of the consent decree, I would bet my next paycheck that there's little or no discretion being exercised by investigators on the street where a number of these cases in other jurisdictions that are not under the same supervisory review wouldn't even file that case.
That's possible.
Because of evidentiary challenges on the scene. So what happens is they fall out later in the process. So we're not comparing apples to apples when we're looking at other jurisdictions. How do I know that? Because I've experienced it. Mm-hmm. I've studied it. I understand where that is. Mm-hmm. I've talked to officers in the NOPD. They have little or no discretion. When you got a he said, she said, no overt physical injuries, nothing else out there, in most jurisdictions, there's not an arrest going to be made. In this jurisdiction, there is. So the fallout occurs somewhere else in the process. But unless we have a conversation with everybody sitting at the table, digging into it in order to find out what is the root cause, this is all conjecture.
Exactly.
And to make dispositive statements like these, I think is very, very destructive to building collaboration and dealing with one of the most problematic types of crimes that we have in our community. And y'all know I feel that way about it because I've sat at the chair with you.
Yes, you have.
And testified alongside of us.
But, you know, yeah. I mean, we got to be fair where fair is and think about these issues in a much more holistic way. We'll continue this conversation when we come back. This is Newell on WWL. All right, we're back with Kim Sport, Charmaine Cassiope from United Way, and Mary Claire Landry from she's the executive director of the New Orleans Family Justice Center. So I was glad to hear, Mary Claire, that you talked earlier and said that the DA's office had actually reached out to you and they're willing to sit down and talk about this. So in the end, what is going to be the next step? I mean, you guys are the advocate. Y'all got a stronger voice than anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, you represent a large group of victims that are impacted. You probably interact with them more than the police and the DA and others do, quite frankly, if we're going to be honest about it. Mm-hmm. So, you come with a big stick.
Yeah. Yes. Well, my strategy tomorrow with the DA is to reengage. You know, he has reduced the resources at the Family Justice Center, so I'm going to advocate that he reinvest in those cases, that he work with us to help identify the most at-risk cases, really to focus on the felony cases to make sure we're really getting convictions on those really serious cases. And then as a system, I really do believe that the criminal justice system is not the response that we need for many of these misdemeanor cases. We have to, as a community, find resources so that we can, you know, especially with bail reform and some of the anti-jailing policies and positions that our community has taken, if it's not going to be a criminal justice accountability situation, then what is it? Because just to not do anything is really sending a terrible message to victims. It's sending a really bad message to perpetrators, telling them they can get away with this. So we do, as a community.
It's just one of many bad messages when you look at some of the bail practices that have gone on and some of the horror stories that flow there.
Mm-hmm. And listen,
we've got people getting out on rapes. Rapes.
Right. And it was never designed.
Not a simple battery.
Yeah.
Right.
It was
a
never.
Rape,
right. It should.
For little
it
or no
money.
It
was never designed to be for violent, you know, offenses. And so we're trying to figure out what's happening there because, you know, I don't want someone to stay in jail because he's poor and because he can't afford bail to get out. I'm not for that. But I am about really trying to figure out if it's not the criminal justice system and if we don't have the resources to address these misdemeanor cases, then somebody should be screening them. Somebody should be looking at what, and if they shouldn't be charged, then we should not charge them. And we should refer them, you know, to some other type of program. And so that's the kind of conversation I'm going to start having with the DA tomorrow to see because, you know, he's reduced his advocates' presence at the Family Justice Center from 4 to 1. So that means there's nobody really addressing the situation with the victims. And That's where we can play a huge role.
Do you believe that that's a lack of desire on his part?
I really don't know. He's never communicated. For eight years, he had four advocates.
I've known Leon probably most of my adult life, and I knew the guy that ran against him. Actually, I supported the guy that ran against him way back. But the realities are, I've known him to be a very sincere individual in his prosecution. Mm-hmm. I suspect that this is going to be a funding problem, quite frankly.
I think it is. I mean, we remember when the council reduced the funding, by $600,000. That funding was reinstated. Then we changed the juvenile justice system, and the DA asked for more funding to help deal with that transition. And I think that he was criticized for asking for more funding. And now I see that there's more money needed to deal with the opioid crisis. There's just no way that with this many cases, we're talking about almost 4,000 cases when you put them together between municipal court and criminal district court, that there's any amount of staff that can be funded that can take care of the problem. The caseloads are enormous. The ADAs that are assigned to these cases are probably some of the lowest paid attorneys coming out of law school that we have.
Mm-hmm. See, what struck me about that number, Kim, you've been around
funding.
A long time.
Yes.
The active criminal docket in Jefferson Parish, and we make a few thousand less felony arrests than they do in Orleans, is about 4,800 to 5,000 active cases on the criminal docket. And if you're talking about 4,000, what we assume might be prosecutable cases, that one category right there may be two-thirds or three-quarters of the entire criminal docket in the city of New Orleans. So when I look at these outcomes like this report, I start thinking in the context of those mm-hmm. numbers.
Right.
So if I'm making in Jefferson Parish 30,000 felony arrests a year, and I have 4,800 active cases on the criminal court docket, there's a huge fallout mm-hmm. of cases. Mm-hmm. There's pleas. There's evidentiary failures. They don't accept cases. That's part of how this plays. But whenever we have this rub of offender accountability versus victim's personal resolution as to what they're looking for here, and you have a recalcitrant victim, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, because I think a lot of it has some sincere motivations as to why they don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
We're not experts, none of us are, in making cases without a victim witness.
Correct.
Those are the toughest cases to make.
Right. These come down to credibility decisions. And you're right, without corroborative evidence, it's difficult, but I'm hopeful that with police cameras, much better forensic screening of victims, and more protection for victims while they are willing to participate in the prosecutorial process, that we'll be able to do that and get more of these cases prosecuted. The coercion, the intimidation, the retaliation that these victims face.
It's real.
It's off the chart.
But it's real.
It's very real. It's very real. So, it's he said, she said. But at some point, we have to do something to make sure that what comes from the victim and goes into the police report and then goes to the DA's office and then the arrestee goes before the judge, that there's appropriate bail, that we're not just giving a slap on the wrist type of sentences in serious cases, and that at least we are charging them with the right crime, not just misdemeanors, not after we've worked so hard to make most of the domestic abuse battery and battery of dating partner crimes felonies.
The DA brought the situation up of these material witness warrants. Obviously, there was legislation that did away with it. These very same folks were very critical of the DA for engaging in the the utilization of material witness warrants. I saw that in his press release, he mentions that, you know, to try and take that first step to compel a victim, a domestic abuse victim, to come in and testify. I think it's a tool in a toolbox. If used effectively, can be effective, or utilized appropriately, can be effective. But, you know, the fact of removing that tool, again, we created a slippery slope for the prosecution of cases.
Well, I just have to say, Neil, I would never support the jailing of a victim after what she has suffered. To re-traumatize that victim in a very punitive way is not the answer. There's got to be other answers to wrap them in safety.
It's a balance of interest, though, because what we are doing is we're villainizing the system. And the system is handcuffed in many respects because we have an adversarial system. And we have the right to confront our accuser. And that is paramount in our system of justice. So when I remove the emotion away from the domestic violence type cases, and I just think of this in the abstract of process, that makes cases really hard to prosecute. And it requires a lot of corroborative evidence that we don't typically go and seek and utilize in a lot of cases because we don't have to. So it makes the funding formula, it goes right back to the onus of the council. They want to get serious about domestic violence cases. They want multidisciplinary teams. Fund it.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
You know, fund it. Mm-hmm. It ain't going to be cheap, though. Mm-hmm. You know, it will not be cheap because these cases have to overcome all kinds of the traditional notions of fair play and justice in our criminal court system. You know, we didn't even mention the funding of OIDP, Indigent Defender Board program.
And that's abysmal.
I mean, if you don't have defense lawyers representing these folks that get clogged in the system, it's hard to get on docket in the first place. And you know as well as I, the sooner that you can get a domestic violence case before a judge, the higher the likelihood of a conviction.
Yes.
Correct.
The longer
that's
that case, because we argued that.
Mm-hmm.
Before
yes,
the legislature.
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. And the longer it takes to get it before a court, the greater the fallout.
Correct.
Because then when we go to prosecute the case, they may be back together.
You're right.
In Jefferson Parish, the victim used to be able to go and sign the perpetrator out on an ROR bond.
Yep.
I was one of the ones that eliminated that practice because I said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of in my life.
Right. I think we have to have appropriate risk assessments. We have to make sure that our judges apply the law. And, you know, we used to have Gwen's Law. Those bail hearings now are not mandatory. They're discretionary now. And I just think that we can do a little bit better job maybe of even creating a cooling off period of sorts. Because no one's more angry than right after they're arrested or right after they've been served a protective order or, you know, after they spent one night in jail. I mean, they're thinking about, maybe somebody's going to pay for this.
No, I agree. I agree. Absolutely.
And then with victims, you know, victims are even coerced by their own families. Like, how are you going to support your children if you're sending your husband to jail?
The trickle-down effect
is
enormous. And I think, you know, Mary Claire in her opening statement said that. I mean, I get it. I understand. And that's that power and that control thing.
Yes.
I forgot the name of the model that they, the study that talked about it. But, you know, that's real.
Right. Power and control is real.
I've seen it.
Yes.
You've seen it.
Yes.
We've all seen it, you know, in the prosecution of these cases. Got to get to a break. We'll be right back.
Can't do a thing about it.
We're back. We're talking to Kim Sport, Public Policy Committee Chair for the United Way, as well as Charmaine Cassiope, who's part of public policy with them as well, and Mary Claire Landry, the Executive Director of the New Orleans Family Justice Center. We were talking offline. One of the other challenges is this bifurcated court system that we have between civil and criminal district court. And Kim, if you would outline some of the challenges that that presents as well.
Well, for one thing, most victims go to get their temporary restraining orders and protective orders and file for divorce and child custody and things like that in the civil court system. And whereas these charges have to be brought and prosecuted within the criminal justice system. The problem there is that a judge probably has a courtroom full of defendants, and are they going to take the time to check to see if perhaps this person has a protective order out against them? Does the DA's office or the police put that into their reports that there's a protective order in place? A law was just passed this year that requires the civil courts to tell a victim when they apply for a protective order whether or not that protective order is granted, that this is not a criminal complaint. You have to go to another place and file a criminal complaint, because so many victims thought by getting that protective order that they were indeed filing a criminal complaint.
Just another example, I think, of this multidisciplinary team mm-hmm. concept and approach where, you know, we're fragmented in many cases. I mean, and it's not just Orleans. I'm not beating up on just – you see this across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, and going back to what Mary Claire had to say, the jurisdictions that have had success have had at these adequately funded multidisciplinary teams. And, I mean, you can point to any number of them. It was the same thing in dealing with mental health. Everybody followed the Memphis model as a result of a case where a police officer was taken hostage and tortured by someone who had serious mental illness. As a result of that, in a number of other cases, everybody adopted this Memphis model, which was a multidisciplinary approach. We did it at the sheriff's office. We created the crisis intervention team. We went through the crisis intervention training. Everybody in the department, NOPD, has done the same thing. It's that kind of push and agenda that needs to be advocated for in order to get to this and fund it. And it's not correct. Cheap.
It's not cheap.
You know, for us, another 40 hours of training. You have to be recertified. You know, there's any number of things that you have to do. But if we're going to make it a priority, I think we need to be honest about how we're going to make it a priority.
Well, and I would just like to say in reference to that, 12 years ago we created the Family Justice Center, the New Orleans Family Justice Center, for that purpose, and that purpose alone is to really build a collaborative, integrated response to domestic violence. And that's what I really want to engage the DA on, going back to that original commitment, because he can't solve this alone. We can't solve this alone. NOPD cannot solve this alone. It takes a community effort to fund. And you're right, it's not cheap. I mean, I pay a lot of money to support this initiative and this collaborative in the city, because I absolutely believe it's the only way that we're going to resolve these issues. But I tell you, I'm desperate for money to really continue the kinds of initiatives that I know work. We know how to address this.
Yeah.
We have the practices. We know how to solve this. We just don't have the resources to really put it in place.
Look, I love copying success. If there's a successful model somewhere else, I don't need to go reinvent the wheel. Let's go copy it, right?
Right.
We'll be right back for y'all's final thoughts. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Mary Claire, we really appreciate what your organization does. Y'all are there in day in, day out. Through thick and thin. We understand that.
Well, and our whole goal is to create a collaborative, integrated system of response to domestic violence. And it just can't be the criminal justice system. We have to look at other types of interventions that are addressing lifetime trauma, the trauma that many of these perpetrators are living with, the family systems you know, the criminal justice system has really been a factor in destroying communities of color. So we have to think about this in a different way, and we have to have multiple responses. We just can't rely on one overburdened system that to address a community-wide system. Violence in the home is something that we have to address, and violence in the home is going to result in violence in the community. And if we're not willing to invest in what's happening to kids in the home and to people in the homes and provide alternatives.
I want to thank all of y'all today. Thank you so much for coming in.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.